Welcome to Prussian Socialism, bringing you culture, whether you like it or not. So, I'm here with Romanized Visigoth. It's been a while, but about a year since we've done an episode, but it's great to have you back on. And you've been telling me that you read Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, and this is a favorite book of mine. It really helped me formulate, put a lot of things into categories that I hadn't really put into categories before. So throughout my schooling, I'd always felt like, well, talking about the civil rights era or something like doesn't seem as important as they make it out to be. I don't understand why we're spending months on this when we've spent a week on ancient Greece. This seems out of balance. And, you know, through the years, I sort of developed my own view of history. But then when I read Spengler for the first time in college, not in class, of course, I didn't read my readings for class. It really like brought things together for me. And I was like, wow, this is a person who's really thought about not only history, but a whole bunch of other fields and made sense of them in a way that I think is far more mature and far more balanced than anybody else that I've ever read. And while a lot of his claims are extremely bold and perhaps even ridiculous, many people have written Spengler off and said that he's just completely wrong about certain things. But he is so completely right about some things and so much more than the conventional view of history that we can't stop talking about him. And we haven't been able to stop talking about him for 100 years. So, Roman, what was your impression of Spengler overall? I guess what do you think he's right about? What do you think he's wrong about from the macro view of philosophy, history, science, math? Like, what fields does he get and what fields does he not get? And then we can kind of narrow it down from there.
Well, my first impression, first of all, the book is it's nicely written. Even in English, it's nice to read. He's a good writer. And there's no point at which it feels boring, even though it's two big volumes and very dense with footnotes, basically every page, sometimes taking up a third of the page, where he'll just make a passing comment and then have to explain what he's talking about.
Yeah, it's also just very dense in references. It's just name after name, book after book. And you have to have read a lot to know it or to get it. There will be whole passages where I'm like completely lost, and then whole passages where it's like I get every single thing he's saying. So,
yeah, and the way he writes about it, it's pretty clear, because when he's writing about things, he's putting them together contextually. So he's saying this is like this, or this thinker is applying this kind of idea to this realm the way this thinker did in this realm. And the way he talks about it, it's obvious that he's read those things. He's not just throwing in references to sound smart or whatever, you know, right. Like a Latin quote. The way that he's discussing issues, it would be he has to have not that he has like a perfect understanding of all these works, but he has at least read them and considered them himself. Yeah, I think his overall thesis that culture civilizations are the largest macro organisms that we have yet to consider, that we could consider, and that they have a life that starts, you know, that they evolve out of organic material, which is the people that create them. They have sort of like an early evolution. You know, they have a childhood, they have a maturity, and then they have a decline and a death. And that all of human, you know, the human race civilization, like, is not one connected thing from like the first guy in 2001, you know, with like the stone, like with the bone, the obelisk, all the way to like us, you know, that there's discrete, like in a petri dish, there's discrete colonies that are popping up and growing and perhaps influencing each other, but are not of the same lineage. There's not just one human cultural lineage from whenever the first, you know, pre-culture may have happened somewhere on Earth till now. I think that's correct. insofar as a very like theoretical, almost metaphysical theory can be correct, I think it's true.
Yeah, it's sort of his claim is not that there is causation or something within within like human cultures. It's not like you can't apply the scientific laws to human cultures. I think Spengler often gets put in a box and people say, well, he's making scientific claims about history. It's like, no, he's not. All he's saying is that if we are looking at history, the way to analyze it is to see these surface forms and then sort of analyze it the way a naturalist might analyze flowers or birds or something. You look at what we see and then try to work our way down to what are the right categories? Like, does this civilization or this culture or this nation belong within this other nation? Like, it's sort of like a Linnaeus doing breaking down the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and then into phyla and subspecies or species and families and all that.
Yeah, as a biomedical scientist, I mean, he goes pretty hard against Darwinism in general. And the way he uses the word race, I'm sure will rub a lot of people the wrong way.
He does equivocate, I think, on the word race. I mean, you can tell when he's using it one way and when he's using it another way.
I think he means breeding most of the time, like stock breeding, like a racial core of your people, as opposed to, cause he'll say some men have race or men of race.
Yeah.
It's a very old, you almost have to have read a lot of old literature to kind of get what he's saying. It's sort of it's not a way people talk anymore.
But the way I understand it, he's trying to put spiritual things before physical things. So that's why he rejects Darwinism outright. Is he's just like, well, this is attributing a material cause to something that we have to attribute spiritual causes to. And so that's why
metaphysical.
Metaphysical, sure.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that to be as critical as possible, I guess, I think that he's actually making a bit of a mistake there, because he's sort of making – he kind of wants to have it be material or materially able to be analyzed in a material fashion with a material analysis when he wants to. And then sort of hand wave like the ultimate cause of things as something it's almost like he prefers aesthetically that certain things be mystical and that we look into the things that he wants to look into. I think he was very impressed with Goethe, who had a similar idea that like, you can't study living things by the way scientists do now, you know, where you like kill them and then like sort of extract their components and do some type of technique to measure how much of this do they have. Like, I gave them this drug, or this is this species. Does it have more of this than this? And that you're losing the category of the living thing when you try to grab onto it with an analysis of its dead matter, which has to happen in order to. So he almost is kind of like he's almost approaching science denial.
Yeah, is he making a category error? Or I feel like we're so surrounded by like a materialist Darwinian worldview now in the West, well, especially in the English speaking world, that that these like a Spengler or a Goethe just comes across as like crazy to a lot of people.
Yeah. Like, for example, one thing that I would say is he rejects Darwinism, and yet I bet if you looked into the genesis of the cultures, there was a Darwinian aspect to it in the sense that certain ideas could have propagated in a pre-culture, but were outcompeted by others and certain peoples. Like, for example, the peoples that became the Greeks were not the only people in that area, and they became the dominant culture. They came from somewhere else. They competed you know, biologically. And he kind of, the way he talks of it, it's almost like he sees men coming out of the earth itself, you know, and like.
Yeah, because it could have been the Lydians or the Etruscans or the Carthaginians who were like the torchbearers of the classical civilization, but it was the Greeks. And you could analyze that from a sort of Darwinian, you could apply Darwinian thinking to history here and say, well, it was the Greeks, they had the superior idea, and that's why they were able to outcompete the other groups and emerge as. But yeah, I mean, I think with Darwin, basically what there's like levels of truth in anything. And you have, as you get to higher levels of truth, you start to realize, I mean, it's sort of a Plato point, right? You realize that the lower level, everything you learned in elementary school was just wrong. And then you get to high school and then you get to college. You're like, no, everything you learned in high school was wrong. I mean, it's almost like that with mathematics. Like when you, I'm no mathematician, but when I got to high school and they started talking about imaginary numbers, I was like, yeah, fuck you. Like, come on. Like, you can't do this. Like, you're just telling me that everything I've learned up to this point isn't true. And it's almost like that. I mean, history too. You study, you know, American history, and then you get beyond the basic talking points about freedom, and you're like, well, all this stuff about democracy and freedom is just fucking stupid, and that's actually just wrong. So it's, you haven't really, it's not that it's wrong. It's just that there's different levels of truth. And I think that's essentially what his claim is about Darwinism. It's not that it's wrong totally. It's just not as efficient of a system. It's like Ptolemy to Copernicus. Ptolemy's system isn't wrong. It's just not a really good way to describe the solar system. Just like Copernicus is, Copernicus describes the planets revolving around the sun. Well, we know now that the sun revolves around the galaxy. So it's not really that the sun is at a fixed point with the planets revolving around it. It's more like the sun is revolving, is moving, and the galaxy is moving, and the planets are all like swirling around the sun. So in a way, Copernicus is wrong. And now we've ascended to this higher level. You think that's fair?
Yeah, yeah. Not only that, but we don't even circle the sun. We circle the gravitational mass center of the solar system, which is basically the sun, but not the exact, because, you know.
Yeah, right. Like, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah, Copernicus. Yes, that's right. I think Spengler is a little, I don't know if it's because he's German, he's continental, that he's antagonistic. I think what he would say is, what he does say is that when cultures, men of cultures, which one must be, if one is to even ask these kinds of questions about nature, you have to, a pre-cultural man would not have such questions, right. A non-cultural man, a non-man. you see it through the lens of your culture. And when you're reaching for, grasping for ultimate truths, whether it's about math, science, art, state form, you're grasping the truths of yourself through your culture. So the English were the English at the time of Darwin were entering a very, that was their culture, you know, the English school of economics, the free market school, it all kind of, so you could see it as England seeing itself, or one English man seeing himself, themselves in nature, seeing what he can see. And that there's perhaps a different way to see the dynamic of how species differentially survive throughout time to change and become what we see now and what we'll see in whatever, 1,000 years. And that there's different ways that different cultures could see that, that would also have facts in them that would be correct, and a different truth, and perhaps facts that are, you know, incorrect, because they're like, for example, I think you made the point that the Greeks could never have thought to do the experiment to figure out that it's not mass that determines the speed that things fall to the earth, because their culture is such like a based on bodies, being everything is like a body and its body characteristics are the important things about it. So yes, if you dropped like two different weights, then the heavier weight would fall faster. Like that's just self-evident to Greeks.
Right. To Greeks, that they would approach it deductively, and they, I guess what Spang would say about the Greeks versus people since, you know, the Renaissance or, you know, Western Europeans is that Western Europeans, Faustians, as he calls us rather poetically, are obsessed with motion and drive and speeds and velocity. And whereas the Greeks, being classical, were very and were their like obsession in nature and in the world was static forms, like bodies that just held their fixed place. And I think it sounds poetic and sort of silly, but if you look at the like ancient Greek statues, you see it's always capturing a person standing still. I mean, but if you look at a Western statue, often, I mean, I'm thinking of some statues I saw outside the Supreme Court when I walked by a few years ago. They're like these heaps of stone that are writhing in motion, and they're very aggressive, like bodies. Just even though it's fixed in stone, you see the potential motion about to happen. And to an ancient Greek eye, that would look ugly and absurd. But to a Western eye, it's like, that's what we want. We are really interested in the motion. So, yeah, getting back to the idea of scientific ideas. Yeah, the Greeks, according to Spengler, would never have the idea to drop two balls, a big heap of metal and then like a little marble. And CO, actually, they do just land at the same time. Mm-hmm. To them, deductive reasoning was the only sort of reasoning, because deductive reasoning, you can move from first principles, and it's much more in tune with their overall picture of the world.
Yeah, and so I think what I was getting at is that the cultures will lead. So it's like you know, like in a combustion engine, how like at the low RPMs it's like the most efficient or whatever for the fuel, and then in the middle is like the power where you can get the most acceleration, and then you get towards the red line and that's where you damage the engine.
Uh-huh.
So I think with the way Spengler kind of describes these cultures, it's like the pre-culture is the low RPMs, and it's like you don't need to put a lot in to kind of get a big it's very efficient, and it's not they're not really running, but they're not producing a lot, but they're producing like the foundation for their mythology and their culture. And then when they reach a really productive period, they're in that power band. And then when they try to get to like the explain everything, like when Aristotle or Plato or whoever is like, this is how the entire universe is, they're kind of hitting the red line and they're starting to, that's when they cultures, all cultures, including our culture, I would say in 1,000 years or maybe even much less, things like the Big Bang, the explanation of the universe and how confident scientists are, like, oh, we've measured it and we know.
Yeah, they'll laugh at that.
And the universe is this many billion years old and we know exactly. It's like that if I had whatever I have to bet, like I would bet right now that
these are like deductions based on assumptions, based on theories.
Yeah, based on measurements of things that often, I mean, the so-called cosmic microwave background, like there's been times when it's been published as measured and it was like bird shit on the antenna until like one lab published findings for like years and years of that. Anyway, so yeah, so then they get to this kind of boundary of humans' ability to like explain reality, and they at that point they're describing themselves. So us, you know, the Big Bang, infinite things like black holes, things that are like infinitely dense, infinitely old, infinite regression, infinite future, is the Faustian explanation of the universe. You know, and whereas the Greek explanation is,
yeah, well, it keeps getting forms. More. It's like there's antimatter, there's
right,
there's atomic particles, subatomic particles, there's parts of electrons. Electrons aren't in one spot. They're actually just probabilistically in one place somewhere within the shell level. I mean, it's like this seems to violate basic Newtonian physics, all of this.
Oh, it all does. I mean, the black hole itself is probably the triumph, because it's a point of specific mass, but infinite density, which is, you know, anti-physics, essentially, because you can't have infinite density, but they have these math equations. But if you think about it, it's exactly where you would go when you reach the boundary of experimentation and you have a culture whose idea is the, you know, infinity drive or whatever.
I'm glad that, you know, as a, you know, science person, you can support and agree with my intuitive, common sense, rejection of these like absurd claims.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that, I'm not saying that all of like astrophysics and physics is going to be overturned, but there's people are making these enormous, you know, claims about understanding. I mean, think about it. They're like, oh yeah, we know exactly how the universe started so many billion years ago, but we still don't have sufficient models to predict like whether it's for sure going to rain in this city or that city tomorrow.
It's like, you're telling me that you have a model that predicts, the Big Bang or, weather patterns in 100 years, but you can't tell me if it's going to rain like 2 days from now with anything more than like 80% or 70% probability. It's like, well, you don't have the mathematical models to show, air displacement or water displacement beyond, or like, turbulence beyond like a few seconds. As far as, I mean, I don't know. I talked to math people occasionally. That was true as of a few years ago. And with my understanding, your knowledge is quite restricted.
Right. So I would say, and I think, so this is an example of, I think, where Spengler is extremely useful, even if you're very turned off by how he talks about science. And even if you think he's factually wrong about certain things, his idea that cultures are explaining themselves in a lot of what they do when they try to explain the world, or that they're kind of, you know, kind of like an author. Oh, I'm writing a story about a detective that blah, blah, blah. But he's really, you know, writing about himself and his life experiences. That's what a culture is doing. They're going out, outward facing, and fighting and trading and engaging in the different cultural activities. But they're always doing it in the way that they do it. And it's not the same as anybody else. So the way Greeks and Romans did some things can't possibly, like, if we went back, we wouldn't be able to understand what they mean in a lot of ways, regardless of the language barrier.
Yeah. Like, I, as a, you know, somebody that was raised as a, you know, an Anglo person of Anglo, I often want to, as I'm reading Spengler, like, try to come up with material explanations for what he's saying. So, for instance, when he talks about like the Greeks and the Romans only, he argues the Greeks and the Romans only got to where they did in math and science in, say, the Hellenistic era with like siege engines or primitive steam engines, because they weren't interested in going. They didn't have that focus on infinite direction like Faustians do. So that's why they like didn't see the purpose of a steam engine, or they could make a torsion machine to shoot a bolt. But the idea of using explosive power to do so just would have never occurred to them. The other way to kind of explain that, or the way one is I'm tempted to try to explain it, is to say, well, you know, you have this development of a culture over several hundred years. And what allows that development to happen is, I sort of approach this socially. You, at first, you know, think of like the Germanic world of 700 AD, 600 AD, just after the fall of Rome. You have warrior bands or little statelets popping up all over Europe and only loose organization. Well, who's the kind of person that emerges as a king in that sort of environment? It's like the guy who's the biggest Chad and who can organize, throw together a band of 10 or 50 or 100 people under his command and lead them. Now, maybe he's not the best leader. Maybe he could never lead an organization of like a million people because he's like, there's all kinds of like moral problems with him or social problems. But in an environment where people are totally broken up, he emerges as a leader. And over time, you see bigger and bigger states emerging, and that kind of initial crop of leadership has to be cut out or is eventually overwhelmed because people are able to organize bigger groups. And so anyway, as this process progresses, eventually you have the unity of the whole civilization. Now, like, how does that explain this phenomenon of, you know, Greeks not getting beyond a certain point in math and science? And I think it has to do with the fact that over time, you're selecting for the various groups are selecting for people with higher intelligence. And there's this phenomenon where the people with higher intelligence, it takes you longer to get the education to be able to contribute in math or science or any other field. And so as you get to the top, well, those people are reproducing less, having fewer children. And so there's an overall decline in the IQ of the total civilization because it's harder to get up there. And that just leads, eventually you kind of top out. You like hit that red line where you're actually damaging the overall organism because you're extracting the smartest people in science and math or the best political leadership. And they're not having children and not those, their like offspring are not being kind of put back into the earth or into the lowest level of the population to kind of then reemerge. And so then you top out at a certain point in terms of technology, art, philosophy, everything, and then you just sort of decline. That's my materialist apology for Spengler.
But that wouldn't be specific to Greece, right? That would be
everybody. Us too, or anybody. Yeah, sure. The Chinese.
Yeah, I mean we're definitely experiencing that. I mean Elon Musk is doing his own artificial attempt at. What does he have? Like 10 kids now, and he just had.
It's what's absurd about that though is it's Elon Musk is the kind of person who thinks that IQ allows a civilization to develop, and I think it's the other way around. It's a civilization developing supports a bigger population of generally smarter people. And once the political organism starts to collapse, then the IQ is going to go down. It's not the IQ creates the higher civilization. It's the higher civilization creates more people with higher IQ.
Yeah. I mean, I would suspect it's both, which actually reminds me of, I think when you were talking about Spengler before, the idea of the culture versus the race.
Oh, you mean that podcast I did? I guess it was back in June. I did two.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, this is one of the aspects of kind of Darwinian Anglo thinking that I don't like, which is that something has to be like, well, is this causing it or is that causing it? Whereas I think things, especially biological things, like, for example, nature versus is it nature or is it nurture? But when you're looking at something like an organism evolving over thousands of years or a civilization, you start with a mass of nature, a genetic pool, and an environment, and they work on each other. You know, so the same environment, if you started with a different group of people, would not produce the same people in the end. And the same genetic stock in a different environment wouldn't produce the exact same people in the end. They would, you know, select out. And so there's a unique combination for an environment and, you know, in the case of a civilization, culture, civilization, a society, a group of people, and they co-evolve. You know, they change their environment. So they start making tools that they need in that environment. They would make different tools in a different environment. But depending on things like IQ, like, for example, Africans, the people that are in Africa and were in Africa, if they were just dropped off in Northern Europe, they would never be able to make it had to be a gradual, let's just assume out of Africa hypothesis.
Yeah. Okay.
It had to be gradual, right? There had to be people that were sort of in kind of cold places. And then, you know, if you just took like from the one to the other, it wouldn't work. So
yeah,
what I'm saying is,
just dropped a bunch of Somalis in Sweden without Swedes there to help them, they would just die.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think there's actually genetic reasons for that too. One of my friends is kind of like a H.B. Duisberg, and he says that actually Northern Europeans have genes to feel more cold so that they don't get frostbite. So that, like, people, if you were adapted to a northern climate, you are more sensitive to when your, you know, your extremities start to become in danger.
I've noticed that. That's funny. I've noticed that. Like, I have, even though I'm Italian, I have, like, far higher cold tolerance than a lot of people who are, like, Nordic. Like, I'll notice more northern European, a lot of friends and stuff I've known will start getting cold, and I'm like, it's not cold, guys, like, stop being pussies. And they're like, it's so cold, Greg. It's like, you're from Northern Europe, like, stop being a bitch, come on. But I guess they're, you know, just that would make sense that they're more, you know, their body is telling them it's cold, time to go burrow under some blankets. And
right,
whereas, like, I'm just gonna die of
oh yeah, or you might, you know, like that that Jack London, what's that story where the guy is trying to get to that campsite in the woods and he's cocky about it and he can't light a fire and he ends up dying of hypothermia?
Oh, that's pretty bad. I got hypothermia. I'm pretty sure I've been in stage 2 hypothermia back when I was an OSU student. They do this thing where you, like, jump in the scummy pond known as Mirror Lake before the big Michigan game. And it's, you know, this is like November, so it's really cold out. You just, like, swim around in it. And you get to a point where you're not even shivering anymore. You actually start feeling hot. I think the next stage is you start not feeling cold at all, or you start not feeling anything. Yeah.
Nice.
It's something. It's like something good to do when you're like 20 and then never do it again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to be in a survival situation, you should know.
Yeah. Know what it feels like, right?
Yeah. But yeah, so the co-evolution. So I would just throw out the whole idea of nature versus nurture.
Can we just throw out causation as well? Can we just say causation, stupid? Can we, like, ascend to that level of epistemology?
Yeah, I think outside of direct experimentation, using the word cause is not that useful. Like, if you're not doing some type of controlled experiment, then... I mean, because there's a lot of causes, right? Like, we understand in layman's terms, like, oh, the brick fell on the guy's head and it killed him. That was the cause. But, like, oh, he didn't have a helmet on. That was the cause.
Yeah.
Or, like, his, you know, if his skull was 2 millimeters thicker, he wouldn't have died. So that was the cause, was, like, an insufficient skull. So it's like there's a lot of causes. So it's kind of context dependent. And I think that's sort of where Spengler's talking past a lot of people. He's staking out a position. He reaches a lot in his book. And I think that he has enough facts and enough, deep analysis of different aspects of cultures that make intuitive sense and that almost make, like, experimental sense in the sense of, you know, like when a biologist will say, okay, we know a whale is a mammal, and you can look, and in their fins, they have, like, little finger-lit thing, you know, things that would have been fingers.
Yeah, vestigial features.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we know that a bat's wings are not homologous to a bird's wings, because a bird's wings are like their arm. The bird's wing comes off of the arm. Uh-huh. Whereas the bat wing, the bats have, like, their wings are
super
their
long
hands.
Fingers or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically like, yeah, like big, enormous webbed finger hands. He does that kind of analysis, which is scientific, basically, or at least science adjacent. I mean, it's not experimental. It's not empirical, but it is dealing with factual things. I mean,
yeah, but all these science facts really need to calm the fuck down, because, like, you know, science only goes so far. Like, science is a method. It is not, it doesn't answer philosophical questions. So, I mean, it's not you. I'm not saying you, but I'm saying, like, when you see Lipschitz talking about, well, this is the dictates of science. It's like, well, but philosophy tells science what to do. So unless you have a deductive epistemological claim that, like, explains how you're conducting these experiments, or deciding which experiments to do, it's silly. So it's not pseudoscience to use to talk in a sciencey way about things outside of science. The word pseudoscience gets thrown around a lot, is what I'm saying.
And the word science.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't trust people outside of if you don't know where somebody's coming from and they use words like science, it's meaningless. You don't know what they're saying. It for half of the population, it just means things I think are cool.
Test tubes and
yeah. So the Spengler ideas, I think they are in their own way testable. And as Russia is in the news and Russian history is in the news, this is a testable. I think that Spengler's one of his core claims, which is that Russia is not part of Western civilization. It's its own burgeoning culture civilization that's like 500 years behind ours, maybe. Like a half a cycle behind ours.
I think it's more like if Peter the Great is Charlemagne, they're about 900 years to 950 years behind us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I think that I think this is clearly true. And a lot of people, if you ask them, why are these relations, these geopolitical diplomatic relations breaking down with Russia at this fault line? And people will say, well, and they'll start talking about, like, if they're on our side, they might start talking about Jewish oligarchs wanting to buy up things in Ukraine and Russia, which is true. But
right.
Why is Poland on NATO's side? Right? Why is the fault line precisely where it is?
Mm-hmm.
Why is Turkey seemingly not on the it's going into the NATO area in this very strange way, which is a prediction. If we want to talk about predictions that might happen with Russia later, I have one that involves Turkey. But
okay.
The reason why the fault line is exactly where it is and how it's happening, I think, is only explained best by Spengler's claim, because Russia is not compatible. The soul of its people is not compatible.
And it's funny because Putin said exactly that in his interview with Tucker the other day. He said, talking about, we Russians are more concerned with this soul, but you Westerners, not a bad thing, not saying it's bad, but you are more practical minded. And, you know, he's making a very Spenglerian point. I don't know if he got that from Spengler. And there are actually Russian thinkers that have kind of taken Spengler, actually one who anticipated Spengler, I think it was Danilov or something. I forget. There was a Russian thinker a few decades before Spengler who made a lot of the same points and kind of broke down civilization into like 10 different cultures, I think, that Spengler, from what scholars know, never knew about this guy. He just like wasn't known in the West. So there wasn't a case of copying or something, but Russian thinking has kind of strangely been going along these lines anyway. But no, I think it's totally like, you know, we could talk about it from an experimental point of view. Like, could we test Spengler's hypothesis out on Russia? But even just from a morphological point of view, I think if you really spend time reading about Russia and studying Russian culture, being around Russians, it's absurd. It like comes across as absurd to say, to analyze these people in like the same terms that you would apply to like Germany or France or England.
If you read the novels, like I read, Crime and Punishment when I was in like middle school. I was one of these kids that if I thought I would look smart carrying around a certain book, I would do it. And then I would actually read it though.
Yeah. See. Okay. That's forgivable.
And I read it. I read the whole thing, and I enjoyed it. And of course, I didn't understand the first thing about it, in the sense that I didn't understand why this guy is poor. He can barely eat, afford food. His clothes have holes in them, and every time he turns around, he's spending hours with a stranger, a drunken stranger in the street, having philosophical conversations about like you know, metaphysical things like God, you know, Raskolnikov, he's like more concerned with
Raskolnikov.
Yeah, with whether the guy whose wife is leaving him is, I forget all the specific scenes, but it's like these in-depth conversations that Spengler would say is happening in the brotherly Russian manner. So the way they interact is like a brotherhood.
Yeah. This is spot on. Russians will always assert, like, we need to have loyalty to our, like, our brother group. And, like, they don't, like, they actually are extremely egalitarian in their attitudes.
Yeah. Raskolnikov, he stumbles into some place of strangers and has all of the problems in the world. And then he starts caring deeply about the woes of some stranger. Not in a German or an English way where somebody would want to offer charity, mm-hmm. or would feel bad, like it's bumming them out, or they feel guilty about having nice things. It's a different way of...
He like feels himself in the other person.
Yes.
He feels like he is the other person. Yeah, that is the Slavic way.
Yes. And so because of that and other things like how they think about trade and money and competition and religion, which they're still developing. At least Spengler says that they're going to develop the next version of Christianity, or they're hot on the trail of doing that, makes them incompatible. And it was tested. It was tested in the aughts. Putin himself tried to basically do a Petronism 2.0 and westernize, or maybe it was some kind of fake out. I don't know. But it seemed as though he was like, okay, let's, you know, the Soviet Union is over.
I bet he was doing Peter the Great because that's his hero is Peter the Great. So I bet he was genuinely trying to do Peter the Great again.
Yeah. He wanted to join NATO and they were going to, yeah, just do a Petronism 2.0. And it was rejected, but it was rejected in a way that it doesn't really make sense, because Jews could loot Russia, but either way, you know, one way or the other. Mm-hmm.
Whether or not Russia was closer
joined to NATO,
amicable with the West or not, yeah.
And what ended up happening is, this fault line, which was there in a way deeper than any of the material things, you know, like how many guns are on here and the resources and money, it materialized the way that it did because of this culture, because it's a different culture civilization, in the same way that I'm trying to think of a similar example, but I guess when Rome broke up, there a fault line was created, right? So classical civilization ended, and the very young Western culture and the very young Arabian culture sort of made a fault line over the spoils. And they couldn't the Crusades were done by Northern Europeans, even though there were Christians there already. But they would never think to do a crusade that way. The way that, you know, the English and the French and everybody came down.
Yeah.
Because that was a Faustian thing. Whereas.
The other reason too is that Arabian culture is like 1,000 years or something ahead of Western culture. So, sounds strange, but true. So. I mean, Spengler would compare Muhammad to Martin Luther. So that's about the place. So in Spengler's mind, the Crusades of the Arabian culture happened, or the like era of romantic poetry and Crusades that happened in the Western world in the 1100s was happening in the Arabian world in like the 200s AD, with some of the like ancient Arabic poetry is reflective of that. I mean, it's a couple centuries after that, but and some of the stories about ancient heroes of like Persia, that circa 200, 300 AD was 1100, was the Arabs' version of our 1100.
Right. And so the Christians that are in that Arabian world, that's a different religion than Western European Christianity in Spenglerian terms.
Yeah, right.
And I think to anybody that isn't just a knee jerk, you know, to be a Christian, you just have to believe in Jesus, or, you know, those kinds of like, you know, you just have to whatever, you know,
the outward form of the Eastern Christianity is like, yeah, the Nicene Creed. I mean, there's minor differences, but outward forms, this looks like Christianity, but the deep spirituality of Eastern Christianity is fundamentally incompatible with the like mysticism that you might see cropping up in Western Christianity. That's the opinion.
Yeah, and that something like the Protestant Reformation and the Atheist Reformation taking Christ out of Western Christianity is something that would have never happened in, that did never happen and wouldn't happen in Arabian Christianity, because it's just not coming at things from the same way. And that Russia is closer to Arabian Christianity, but is still kind of forming its own, at least according to Spengler. And he is predicting,
He's not saying that Russia, like Russian spirituality, is derivative of Arabian spiritualism, but he does say that he's focusing on the sort of there's like an eerie resemblance between Russian culture and Arabian culture, in his opinion. And I kind of see what he's saying. Like there's this, the Russians have this like focus on the sacred, on the Holy Land, that's sort of hard to explain. Why like a bunch of medieval Slavs would be writing, you know, as religious as they were, would be writing tons of books, and poems and stories about the medieval, or about the Holy Land.
Yeah. And do you find it interesting geopolitically? So this is more like getting into the prediction, realm, but isn't it interesting that Russia has a lot of military assets in Syria? And it's like, if you were to say, okay, how could there be a modern crusade? Not exactly the same, but some right. type of incursion into the Holy Land from a new Christianity. What would that look like? Would it look like giving military aid to a beleaguered state in the Holy Land and having a military asset foothold and engaging in conflicts, and sort of by dint of this military activity and kind of the pseudo conquest of being the protector of a state that is not able to protect itself, that's in a way that they're kind of entering the Holy Land.
Yeah, I mean, it's We should be seeing crusades right now, because if from Slavic civilization, you know, according to the Spenglerian model, if Piotr Pierwszy was Charlemagne, then yeah, it's about 1100 right now. And I mean, I don't know if S-400 systems in Syria quite meets the level of crusade, but you know, maybe this is like the lazy Slavic version of a crusade. Whereas in the Western culture, it's like, all right, everybody needs to put their money where their mouth is and go and like die for, you know.
Well, it's
like
slow.
Show their commitment here. Whereas with the Slavs, it's like, all right, well, the Tsar will send the S-400 systems to the Holy Land, and that will be our Christian contribution to this.
It's a slow expanding plane. They have a presence, and it will expand. They're allying with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
They're expanding their influence in a slow and steady way.
Not in our driving, directed.
Yeah, like, it doesn't look like much.
Like the West does.
And it could be 100 years until, and then you look back and it's like, oh wow, Russia is the official overseer of like, you know, half of the Holy Land. You know,
it's like, wow, like why are there Russians in Alaska? I mean, like, how did that happen? Just creeped across Siberia and here they are. Which is, speaking of Alaska, like Russians, like they will still lament the loss of Alaska. Like that was the biggest, Catherine the Great selling Alaska. Catherine the Great, of course, was a German. So her, like, spiritually, she wasn't a slob. So she was like, yeah, whatever, fuck it, we'll sell Alaska. A Russian would never sell Alaska because a Russian is like, will cling to land. And they like still are pissed off about it. There's the top band in Russia is a group known as Yuba, probably top band. I mean, they're like, they've been around for about 30 years and they're a big like folk rock band and Putin loves them. The lead singer is like in the Duma and is like bros with Putin. Anyway, one of their famous songs is Nie Volay Duraka America. Don't play the fool, America. And it's about, and then one of the lines from the song is, Alasochka Ativai, like give us back our little Alaska. And they're like, every Russian knows this song. Like they will quote it to you. It is like a sort of a, I just cite this as evidence of like the popular Russian need for land and this Spenglerian idea that the Russians are like slowly just spreading out.
Yeah, that's their soul form. So the other thing that's interesting is that Turkey, like I was saying before, Turkey is in NATO, right? Or is it in the EU? Which one is it?
It is in NATO.
Yeah, it's in NATO.
Them and the Greeks are in NATO, which is the funniest thing ever. It's
yeah, I think Russia is what kind of wants to continue to smash what's left over of the Ottoman Empire. So I think Russia will look to the Holy Lands, and it will also look to Constantinople. And I think that it's significant that Turkey, it makes all the sense in the world that Turkey would kind of cozy up with Iran. And because they have an issue, right, where they're kind of...
I don't have a good read on the Turks. My like assumption on the Turks is that they're just always like looking to backstab.
Yeah.
They're like Littlefinger in Game of Thrones. They're just like always like, even when it's against when it's against their own interest, it's like stab. I don't know why I should do that. I don't know. He was fucking there. Showed me his back. I stabbed him.
Yeah, I think they've put themselves by taking the whatever bribe, you know, to kind of ally with the Western system at this time. I think they've put themselves in the path of this coming Russian crusade thing. They were already in the path. I think they kind of sense it. They're kind of in it. They're in a bad spot.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a sort of a crumbling outpost of an old civilization in path of a younger.
It's like, yeah, they could team up with Israel or like Iran, but like teaming up with Israel doesn't get them anything and causes them a lot of problems. Teaming up with Iran might work in the short term, but isn't going to, you know, it's like you might as well team with Iran if you're Turkey, because Iran is not nearly as strong as Russia. But at the same time, like Iran has a lot more credibility with the rest of the Islamic world than Turkey does, because Turkey, again, just stab, stab, stab. Whereas Iran has been like helping out all these, you know, providing training and money and weapons to, you know, the martyrs of Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis and the Yemenis government. So Iran has like a lot of credibility.
Peace be unto them.
Yeah.
Peace
so it makes them. Sense that the Turks have to like team up with or have to like make nice with somebody.
Yeah.
And they have an ongoing problem with the Kurds. Like they're like,
well, who doesn't?
Sure. And the Armenians, although, you know, it's funny, like Turkey does have a lot of influence still in the Balkans, which you wouldn't know from looking at a map. But years ago, I passed through Kosovo and it was like very Turkish. I mean, not just that they're Muslims, but people spoke Turkish. And then like there was Turkey. If you could speak Turkish, you could talk to people. And they like were very interested in what was going on in Turkey still. And same thing with Albania too. It's kind of funny that these like ex-Ottoman states 100 years later still feel themselves close to Turkey.
Well, it is a big country. But so all of these Westerners that are, you know, screaming about how Russia is going to enter Europe, I think they have – obviously they're just lying, but they have it totally wrong. If they wanted to actually scream about something that could actually happen in the next – in this century, it would be that Russia may enter Constantinople. And
I can see this. This is a good argument. I like it. Sure, the Russians – like the Russians are weirdly afraid of – attacks from the West. They're like a whipped dog or something. They're just like, oh no, Niemcy fascists are going to come and march on Moscow. And it's like, you're not wrong. I mean, this has happened several times. Like, of course, Hitler, Napoleon, was it Charles the 12th? Was Battle of Poltava, the Great Northern War.
The Swedish?
The Swedish. Charles the 12th. And Gustavus Adolphus also like invaded I want to say the Baltic area, and there was, of course, the Teutonic Knights. Like, the Russians just constantly keep getting, the Poles in the 1600s with the false Dmitry in Moscow. Like, yeah, the Russians are just always getting, like, punched from the West, and they attempted to solve that problem by taking a huge block of land after World War II. Like, okay, we will never have a problem from Niemcy again. We will take everything up to the Oder, or no, up to the whatever line it is in Eastern Germany. We'll take all of it. And then the Niemcy will never come back, and we will be safe forever. And then after 40 years, like, they found themselves having to manage a bunch of Slavs who don't like them, or Westerners like the Czechs, I would say, or, you know, they're Slavic, but they're kind of culturally very, very Germanized. So, like,
definitely.
And the Hungarians. So you have all these like para-Slavic peoples, not really, maybe Slavs, maybe not. Language, yes or no. Religion, might be Catholic, might be Protestant. You know, it might be Orthodox in the case of Bulgaria or Serbia, but like, you have all these peoples who aren't really fully assimilated, or are not fully assimilated into Russian culture, but have like certain affinities, who are just given to revolt and don't want to be forced under Russian control. And so I think Russia now has learned their lesson. Do you think the Russian desire for infinity land is stronger than their fear of having to rule over a bunch of people that they know they can't control because of the historical experience of like the 40-year Soviet occupation of Western Europe, or sorry, Eastern Europe?
For some reason,
NATO answer would be, of course, that the Russians want infinity land and they will like do whatever to oppress the poor peoples of Eastern Europe.
I think that they have some type of sense of their borders, even though that sort of contradicts the infinite plane idea. Mm-hmm. But I think that they have a lot of land, and there's definitely this tendency that they have. But I think that it's been the actual land acquisition component of that tendency, I believe, is an earlier expression of the culture, and that now it's going to express in, especially as it decouples from the West more and more, in arts and their religion, mm-hmm. and their sciences. I think they're going to decouple to whatever extent is possible.
Because, yeah, I mean, the Russians, you know, they could have at some point in the last like 20 years, I think they've realized their limits, like in the Caucasus. Like, they haven't, you know, there was a war with Georgia back in 2008. But they never attempted to conquer or destroy Georgia, because I think they understand that, like, the Georgians are so different from them. They speak a, you know, non-Indo-European language. They have a very strong ethnic identity. Russia doesn't want to be in a situation where it's, like, controlling Georgia, and having to do, like, a 20-year war like they had in Chechnya. I mean, granted, that turned out fairly well for them, because now they have an extremely, like, loyal Chechen, like, army at their disposal. But that, like, came at a massive cost. So, And they already, and plus they have like tons of minorities already with, you know, they've got within the Russian state, you've got various Mongolic peoples, you've got the Tatars in like the Kazan area, you've got Finnic peoples up in northern Russia. You've got all kinds of minorities in Russia that they have to like cut a deal with and who might be a problem. And then you've got also the Central Asian migration that they, you know, from Central Asia into, you know, Russia, into Moscow, St. Petersburg. So.
Yeah, if you look at the earlier history of Russia, there was a lot of physical land expansion. And I think that prime symbol, I think when Spengler talks about prime symbols, it doesn't have to mean the most basic form of that thing. It's like that prime symbol of the infinite plane will express itself in ways that could be land expansion or could be some other way of a civilization expressing itself. I don't think Russia is going to make significant increases. I mean, to make a significant increase to the Russian landmass would be significant indeed, because it's already the biggest landmass. So something they would notice would have to be pretty big. And I don't think that's really what their future. I think spreading to the Pacific Ocean was itself like a, you know, if you imagine like a something spreading, like a dumping over a can of paint, and it's kind of like slowly spreading across the paper. Like they did that, you know, already.
Yeah, I mean, they got conquered by the Mongols once, and they're like, okay, never again. And once they united, you know, once Kiev got annihilated by the Mongols, and they had several hundred years of fighting between the various Russian states, Moscow emerged as binary, and then. You know, with like circa Ivan the Terrible, they really started expanding into that plane, that steppe zone. And then just from circa Ivan the Terrible over like 100 years, they got out to the Pacific, and then they've been sort of settling it ever since. But it's hard to imagine them doing the same thing in a westerly direction.
No, I don't think that. There's something about that that doesn't kind of seem realistic. It doesn't seem to fit either just the understanding, a basic understanding of how the world works, and also a Spenglerian. It seems like they, in the same way that the early European drive for what would be the analogy, like, The Europeans aren't going to find another American continent. You know, they did that once.
Right. I mean, we could have focused European colonization on like Morocco and Algeria. And there was a certain amount of that, like pushing Muslims out of Spain and then like incursions into North Africa. But it didn't really take hold the way it did, like into the Americas or East Asia. Strangely, like Europeans, colonization went all out and around the whole world. And I mean, yeah, you could posit like economic explanations for that, of course, but you would think from like the point of view of the Middle Ages, you would think the Christian drive to like get revenge on the Muslims and secure ourselves from like Muslim incursions ever again would mean that we would like take over North Africa. But as late as like the 18, you know, 10s, North African pirates were causing havoc in the Mediterranean. Even though they were like culturally or not materially far behind the West.
Yeah. See, if Western Europe was Russia, it would have done that. But because it was Western Europe, it intuitively saw that it intuitively expressed itself as sea power over long distances, mm-hmm. as opposed to a slow creep over flat land, even if it's closer.
I want to keep getting into the Russia issue, but I was just thinking, you know, as far as, you know, science being pushed to its very end right now, I mean, well, I guess an objection I just thought of with Spengler is Spengler is so complicated and hard to get your head around. Couldn't it just be that Spengler is sort of the ultimate expression of like the humanities in the West, and that he's like actually kind of pushing into the black hole territory with with history in the same way that the science nerds are with their astrophysics.
Could be. Yet somehow he's so he's not fashionable and never was.
True. As you're reading him, it is clear that, like, if you read him as an American, you probably haven't read any of the books that were current in Germany or among, like, pretty much all of Europe in the early 20th century. So, you know, if any of us were to go have a conversation with a person from, you know, Europe, even England, in World War One, they would find all of us to be horribly uneducated and wouldn't be able to, like, would find us boring and rather stupid. But, you know, and so as you're reading Spengler, you're kind of like, a lot of the things he's saying seem like naked assertions out of nowhere. But as I've read, you know, over the years, some of the other thinkers that were around in the decades before Spengler, it's kind of some of the things start to make a lot more sense. For instance, one of the great historians of 19th century Germany was Leopold von Ranke. And it's funny that this guy is not even known in the West unless you're like he's still known in Germany, but he's not known in the English world, even though unless you're like a history grad student, you've probably never heard of him. But this was the guy that invented the modern historical method of going to primary sources above all else and valuing that information first. Things that are taken for granted in the study of history, were really codified first by Ranke. Also the research model of the university is often attributed to his work. So two like huge things in academics. But anyway, he wrote one of his main theories in history, was the formation of Western civilization being the conglomeration of the Latin South and the Germanic North. And he talks a lot about that and like how those two, cultures came to, or how those two, you know, proto cultures, I guess, came together to form the Western civilization. And Western civilization is both Latin and Germanic. And both of those things are like intrinsic to it. And I think Spengler essentially takes that Ranke thesis for granted and takes it for granted that his readers know that thesis and accept it. I don't remember him ever explaining that. So there's just a lot of stuff like that where you're not, many of these other thinkers haven't been translated or are unavailable or you wouldn't even know who they are. And that's what makes Spengler particularly difficult and particularly unknown.
Do you think that's the only thing, though? I mean, there seems to be something like the Academy doesn't like a different narrative of history.
Sure. Yeah.
For
one thing, Spengler wasn't an academic. He got a PhD, but he wasn't in the Academy. So all the other history nerds were butthurt that somebody wrote this really great book that actually was popular, but not in like the bad way popular. It was widely read and had an impact as an idea. He had an impact in the world of ideas that many of these nerds couldn't do. And so they were butthurt about it. So I think that's part of it. But also more, I guess, relevant to the current world is, his system of history or his idea of history is so antithetical to the like Jewish, ossified Anglo, I don't want to call it Anglo, but like three part history breakdown, the history as progress idea. Spengler is so antithetical to that he's like politically dangerous.
The Whig.
Milord Acton, Whig interpretation or Whig theory of history, I guess it's called.
The Whignat interpretation of history.
What is the Whig theory of history? It's one of those words that I've heard more times referenced than I've heard it explained.
I think it is just that historical forces are progressive. That things are progressing in a direction of getting better. Although that term is...
See, I always blame that on Hegel. Because Hegel's theory of history is essentially that history is the progress of freedom from nation to nation. And at first, the Chinese and the Indians realized that one man was free. And then the ancient Greeks realized that a few men are free. And then the ancient Germans recognized that all men are free. And that's why we have democracy.
Yeah.
Like reading, if you read Hegel and then you read Spengler, I don't know, maybe philosophy people find Hegel impressive. I don't. I find like it's comically stupid from the point of view of someone who's read a lot of history. Hegel doesn't seem to have read any history, whereas Spengler has clearly read a ton. So it's just a much more mature opinion.
Yeah. Also, Hegel, as far as I know, wasn't that anti-Semitic, unlike Kant, who was.
Okay.
So that's so how I think
Kant was
about
anti-Semitic.
It.
I mean, I know all great men are, so I assumed as much. And I know that Kant didn't like the blacks. He wrote a treatise about how much he didn't like blacks in his spare time. Tell me about his anti-Semitism, because I'm curious.
You know, I had just seen a quote going around, and I wonder if I could find it. You know, like sometimes the quotes by Voltaire about the Jews will go around.
I think that quote is spurious. I
mean, not that one.
The attribution is spurious. It's true, but
the one, not that one, not the one about who you can't criticize.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the one, it's a real quote, and it's something like cringing in defeat or something like that, cringing and insolent in victory or insolent in prosperity.
Uh-huh.
He's describing the Jews. He's saying, you know, when they're on top, they have no graciousness.
They're kicked up and kicked down, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they have no pride when they're on the bottom. So, yeah, and there was something like that where Kant said that, like, they hate the entire rest of the world. Because he's coming at it from the perspective of like this growing liberalism, you know, this mm-hmm. kind of enlightened idea. And he was like, these are the least enlightened people. They'll never be enlightened. They hate the entire rest of humanity more than anybody ever has, kind of thing. But in his words.
I want to bring up the sort of intellectual history there just because it is kind of hard to see where Spengler's coming from a lot of things. It's almost hard to get, like in many things, it's hard to, you can't have a conversation about something unless both people are coming from the same intellectual background or at least understand the basic assumptions of the other person. And if you don't have that, you often end up talking past each other. And you see this on the internet all the time, or you see it in American politics all the time. People simply don't have the same background and they just are shouting slogans at each other. And there's no, even if they're trying to honestly have a conversation, they're not easily able to. But I mean, I think that just kind of goes to show the degradation of our civilization right now, because we don't have the same intellectual backgrounds. We haven't all read the same books. And I think part of that is because there's too many books that are considered classic. And so it's just sprawled out in all different directions. People have read a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You couldn't possibly read the whole literary canon that they publish in like the New York Times and say, well, all these books are classic. You have to read all these. It's like, no, you can dispense with the Jane Austen, and like, you know, just read, like literally just read Homer and then we're good. Everything else is like secondary. And if you all have the same background, then you can kind of, you can actually have the more advanced conversations. You can't have the more advanced conversations when everybody has different backgrounds. It becomes, you're spending all of your time establishing like ground rules, before you can even, you know, advance.
And I think Spengler is actually quite accessible. If you just read the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
It lays out his thesis. He gives some examples. He gives like a flyover set of examples of his method. And it's really, I think anybody could just read the introduction and engage with it and interact with it, which is not true probably of if you cracked open a Kant volume or something like that and just...
Because in the introduction, he criticizes right off the bat the idea of a three-part breakdown of history of ancient, medieval, modern, and says, well, this is, you know, this makes sense if you're just looking at the world from, like, if you draw a circle around, like, Italy, France, and mainly just Italy and France, that kind of makes sense as a historical perspective a little bit, because everything was great up to the end of Rome, and then things were, like, in abeyance for a long time, and then there was another rise. But if you look at, like, Russia, and you talk about medieval Russia, it's like, well, what is that versus ancient Russia? There was no like collapse in Russia in 400 AD. So, or in China for that matter, there was a collapse in circa 200 AD in China. So what are the Chinese Middle Ages? You know, well, the Tang Dynasty seemed to be more advanced than the Han Dynasty. Like, why would we talk about Middle Ages? You know, the categories don't make sense. And he's very persuasive in making those arguments. And then also pointing out like prehistoric civilizations like, Babylonia or Egypt, you know, we didn't know about these things 100 years before. And he's writing in 1918. But now we know so much about this, and it's extended our timeline backwards by 2,000 or 3,000 years.
Yes. And that clearly, if it was a straight line of civilization, you couldn't have a bunch of developed civilizations like that did not contribute to the development of what we have now.
Well, and also, like, well, more of a petty complaint, but like, why does the art seem to suck after the middle of the 19th century? You know, like, it should be getting better, but now it's getting worse. Why have there not been good philosophers since about 1799, I guess, was when Kant died? So, like, why has everything seemed to just... We've had like John Stuart Mill, you know. This seems to be a regression.
Well, because, and Spengler would say, we're moving into the age of technics, right? Away from lyrics. So yeah, the great minds after that time period have gone into like coming up with, you know, brain surgery or
right,
whatever.
So
rockets.
Or politics. So, you know, Bismarck was a successor to Kant in a way, because he was a great mind of his civilization. He wasn't going to go into, you know, philosophy. Philosophy was done. He was going to go into politics. We can draw a straight line pretty much from like Descartes to Kant to Napoleon to Bismarck to Hitler.
Yeah. Well, sure.
To Elon Musk, perhaps. No. Just playing, very much just playing. Not Elon Musk, because he's a shill for the Jews.
He is, though, indicating a very attentive the readiness of our civilization for a Caesar.
Yes. Do we want to go on to Elon Musk cucking for a little bit?
I mean, what else is there to say? It's gotten. What was it, 2 weeks ago when he was going and watching the Holocaust videos and banning
Yeah, right.
People.
He did his trip to Auschwitz and the Western Wall or whatever. He went and kowtowed before Netanyahu.
It's grotesque. I mean, is that what you have to do to have like $100 billion?
I guess. I mean, it's like from the Spengler point of view, though, like he is like Musk. I know I said this in the last podcast where I talked about Spengler, but he is interesting in that he is this kind of person that Spengler predicts should emerge in Western society. Now that nobody's doing philosophy, nobody smart is doing philosophy. Nobody smart is doing art because the art's just going to suck. All the smart people, all the really great minds of their civilization are going to go into either politics or science, application of science, like technics, like being a big multi or capitalism and making billions of dollars and building a great corporation, being a Cecil Rhodes is the model that Spengler puts out. And like, yeah, Elon Musk does kind of fit that, but like in this pitiful, like Jew friendly way that I don't think Spengler foresaw how like lame our great politicians of 100 years after him might be.
Well, I think he would say that we're in the time of the money power, right? And the coming Caesarism.
Sure, but
and
we should be approaching the end of the money power cycle though now. I mean, we were coming out of it.
The old state forums are tearing down, right?
Yeah.
So there are men who will perceive this, and this is why, for example, the conservatives hated Trump so much, because he basically just said out loud that the old forms are dead of the American Republic, which everybody sensed, and so many people responded to it because it was true. And they said, oh, he, you know, the way he talks is uncouth. And it's basically the same thing they could have said about Caesar or the Gracchi.
Right.
The question is, who is actually going to successfully achieve that kind of the Caesarism? And yeah, it's probably not going to be somebody who's financially like beholden to, you know, international Jewish finance.
Yeah, Musk has like masterfully played the game to get himself to build himself up as like a huge figure and get a tremendous amount of power. But at the same time, he did so in such a way where he's still beholden to Jews. And so it's, you know, Spengler does comment a good amount on Jewish power, and he's like, I want to read him as he is so anti-Semitic that he's like beyond hating Jews. He like understands them for what they are. And he's just kind of like, yeah, they're. So his take on Jews is that they are the reason that Jews have so much power in Western civilization is because they are part of a different culture that has already matured. And because, you know, 1918, when he's writing, what he, in his opinion, Western civilization is not quite achieved its final form yet, we Westerners are sort of like we're like high tier PhD students, but the Jews are like doctors. So the Jews have doctorates in culture, whereas we're like on the edge of getting our PhD. And so we're in competition with each other, and they're like playing the game just ever so slightly better, which is what makes us really fucking hate them. Because like we're almost there and we can almost beat them, but we're not. We just need a little bit. We need to push a little bit more, and then we'll be up at their level, and then we can finally beat them. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened, and like our civilization is like totally controlled by Jews. I mean, we might. Do you think Spengler would say that now Western civilization since 1945 has gone into a pseudomorphosis where we've been like turned into a zombie, and our brain's been replaced by this like ancient civilization, or the remnants of that are now controlling us?
That would probably be the biggest question that I would want to ask him, is like, if you could, you know, get his take on something in the modern world, it would be like, what do you think of this, you know, this,
yeah, so like Jewish money question power here. Should money power, like he predicts money power, and there's going to be a 200-year period about roughly of money power. And in the classical civilization, it was, say, the Battle of Zama to the Battle of Actium, 200 BC to 30 BC. That was like the money power period. We entered the money power period around 1815. So we're like, this should be endgame right now. We should be getting into, we should have Caesar coming along. And we should.
I think that we have. I think everything is indicating that that is happening, or it's right around the corner. I mean, the public's response to
Trump
and to Musk, even regardless of what you think of them, indicates that that itself is a symbol and a sign.
I would agree that like Caesar or Blumf is Caesarian, but he's not. He's like a, just as Musk is like a pitiful, shitty version of Cecil Rhodes, Blumpf is like a shitty, shitty, pitiful version of Caesar. Can you imagine Caesar like being like, "We're going to march on the Capitol. Yeah, it'll be awesome." And then like, oh, standing in the White House office watching it. Can you imagine Caesar standing in the White House office watching his like partisans storming the Capitol and be like, oh, shit. Oh, man, that's really great. Oh. And then like watching them get thrown in prison and then just blustering about it and then being like completely incompetent. Like Caesar would go out there and be like, how dare you? You've taken these people and I. Like he would make a big grand gesture. He would take Caesar would like liquidate his assets to like provide for their political defense in the courts. Like,
yeah.
Whereas Trump is just like, oh, it's so bad. It's so bad. Like, we're in like clown world, Caesar.
Well, the thing is there, you know, the brothers Gracchi and others around that time, the proto Caesars, they didn't have either the skill or the follow through to pull it off. And then there was also Crassus, who kind of had the follow through, but not the right. So it's just it's a slot in the civilization that's waiting to be filled. It's moving around, and there's going to be all of these, you know, people that it seems like this is the guy. It seems like this is the guy. You can't see. That's the thing. Spengler, I guess one way you could criticize is that there's no method for saying, oh, this is the thing is happening right now, for sure, right now. And here's how I know this, and this. It is a retrospective.
Right. Because there couldn't be a predictive thing because you can't predict in history. And like Spengler recognizes that.
Yes.
His like opinion on the future is that there's, if you're looking in the future, you have to recognize what is possible and what isn't possible. And you either do the possible thing or you don't do it.
And also what is almost inevitable. So he would say it's almost inevitable that there will be a Caesar. It's just who it is and what that looks like and whether it's this year or in 10 years. That's incidental.
Yeah, because Trump, I wouldn't even compare. Like Trump, I think, is closest to Tiberius Gracchus, the reformer in Rome who wanted to redistribute land to the soldiers and the peasants away from the senatorial aristocracy that just bought up all the land in Italy and was farming it with slaves from the East. So Gracchus like was pushing for the reforms that were absolutely necessary, and Trump also pushes for the reforms. Some of the reforms are absolutely necessary and obvious, and he just can't get them because the political system, the interests of the individuals who constitute the elite are against allowing that. Their individual interests are all in more immigration and more faggotry and yada yada yada. So like nothing can get done. But I still say that Trump is like a clown version of Tiberius Gracchus, because Tiberius Gracchus at least had the decency to die for what he believed in. And so did Caius Gracchus. And so did Crassus in a way. I mean, he like blundered his way into
a more
military annihilation at Carrhae. But, you know, Caesar, obviously, Pompey as well. Like literally all these guys like died for what they believed in. And, you know, I guess Trump, you know, Trump could be a martyr in his own cause, I suppose, but I don't think I think January 6th was the moment on the forum where like the Gracchus supporters were annihilated by the goons of the Senate, and Trump, unlike Caius Gracchus, Trump just wasn't there.
That's correct. But in a way, this is a really gay version, but his getting taken off of Twitter after that, his
Caius Gracchus running through the streets begging for, will someone lend me a toga?
Banned from Twitter.
And then being cut down by goons, tragically dying in the service of the people. Then Donald Blump censored from Twitter.
Yeah, but and his legal troubles. I mean, there is it is unprecedented to legally harass a former president. Mm-hmm. And so if you take, you know, in this version where things aren't as dramatic.
It is comical, like legal troubles. He got convicted, or not convicted. He lost a lawsuit for slandering a woman because he denied fucking her. And what's crazy about it too is if you like do the calculation on the ages involved, it's like they were both in their late 40s, and she claims that like he took her into the Bloomingdale's like changing room and banged her, and that this was a rape. And then 30 years later, he denied raping her, and therefore he defamed her. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, one could almost see something like that popping up in Caesar's. I mean, there were sexual.
There were equally comical, maybe not equally there were comical things in Caesar's like career. I'm thinking of, what was his name? Clodius. You know Clodius?
The Greek?
He was a minor.
Oh, the one that dressed up as a woman to sleep with his wife at that festival or that religious ceremony where only women could be there.
Yeah. He sneaked into the house of, I want to say Caesar's wife or his cousins or no, Brutus. I don't remember. Some Roman aristocrat. He sneaked into their house wearing a wig because he wanted to bang one of the women there. And they caught him like in women's clothes, or the women caught him, and it was a whole scandal. And no, it got even funnier. I want to say there was like a public, there was like some kind of like serious public ritual humiliation as well. It was bizarre. I mean, truly clown world stuff, but it still wasn't as absurd as like the stuff we see now. Like I think Faustian civilization has produced even more ridiculous forms than classical civilization could dream of, because in classical civilization, like a faggot was still a faggot. Like it was still laughed at. Now it's like sanctimoniously talked about. As much as there was faggotry going on in late Rome and in late Republican Rome, even it was never talked about as like a religiously like good thing or moral thing.
Oh, certainly not. But yeah, I mean, this gets back to, you can't really compare those two things, in a direct comparison.
Mm-hmm.
But listen to this. I have some, speaking of with the Jewish control, some of these quotes. Islam has soil under it. It has practically absorbed the Persian, Jewish, Nestorian, and Monophysite consensus unto itself. The relic of the Byzantine nation, the modern Greeks, also occupy their own land. The relic of the Parsis in India dwells in the midst of the stiffened forms of a yet older and more fellahized civilization and is thereby secured in its footing. But the West European American part of the Jewish consensus, which has drawn to itself and bound to its destiny most of the other parts of Jewry, has now fallen into the machinery of a young civilization, detached from any land footing since centuries ago, so that's now outdated. It saved its life by shutting itself off in the ghetto. It is fragmented and faced with dissolution, but that is a destiny not in the Faustian culture, but of the Magian. So other than the fact that they made Israel, but if we would just take this at face value, that Jewry is actually, that the Jewish part of Magian civilization is going to dissolve inside of Faustian civilization. Looking at what the problems Israel is having right now, I mean, does anybody think that that really is a long-term geographical place for them? That they really belong there in the same way that like the Indian people or whatever belong in their country? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, with the Jews, I kind of thought you were going a different direction with that. Like Jews in the West, like that they've been like cut off from the rest of Magian civilization for so long, they've sort of undergone a false morphosis, a pseudomorphosis, I guess.
Well, I think what he's kind of saying is a very fancy way of, you know, like in the what's that like comic movie with the Watchmen, when the guy's like, I'm not trapped in here with you, you're in here with me in the prison.
Right.
It's like, it seems like we're trapped in here with the Jews are running this civilization, which they are. But in a sense, like maybe if you zoom out and then looking into the future, that's like the 2% of a society can't actually functionally control the rest of it in a meaningful way. That maybe they're like sealing their own fate in this action.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. Because their spirituality is so dead and ours is like at its most mature point. So therefore our civilization will crush the Jewish soul within it. And these Jews will just be turned into like bastions. it's a daring theory, Herr Spengler, but, Herr Doctor, I don't know.
I mean, he says a few things. I mean, under the money chapter, he says the Jews of those times were the Romans. So back during Roman times, and the Jews were.
Yes. No, I see the argument here. He's arguing that like the Roman civilization was fully mature. And
yeah.
he talks about how when Mithridates of Persia staged a conspiracy across like Turkey, then now Turkey, then Anatolia, Asia Minor, to kill all of the Romans who had, this is circa 100 BC, 90 BC, something like that. All the Roman like merchants throughout like Asia Minor, they slaughtered like several thousand Romans overnight. All these like, you know, Anatolians did. And that was because the relationship of the Anatolians to the Romans was that of us to the Jews. It was a younger civilization being dominated by agents of an old civilization and feeling very exploited and just lashing out in like total rage and just butchering them. And he uses the word pogrom to describe this like killing off of Romans. And this was the incident that provoked like Sulla's invasion of Asia. But yeah, okay. And I can see, yeah, the Romans, we was Jews, in a sort of civil Spenglerian metaphysical sense, we was Jews.
Sure. Also, today, this Magian nation with its ghetto and its religion itself is in danger of disappearing, not because the metaphysics of the two cultures come closer to one another, for that is impossible, but because the intellectualized upper stratum of each side is ceasing to be metaphysical at all.
Right.
It has
right.
lost every kind of inward cohesion, and what remains is simply a cohesion for practical questions. The lead that this nation has enjoyed from its long habituation to thinking in business terms becomes ever less and less vis-a-vis the right. American it has already almost gone. Americanism.
The intellectualized upper stratum of America. We are so cynical that we have become Jews, and we can now finally compete with Jews. The and American is like overcome the Jew. He has become the Jew.
He has a almost like a threatening ending here. And with the loss of it will go the last potent means of keeping up a consensus that has fallen regionally into parts in the moment when the civilized methods of the European American world cities shall have arrived at full maturity. The destiny of Jewry, at least of the Jewry in our midst, that of Russia is another problem, will be accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's the solution to the JQ. That's the final solution will be a fully cynical American businessman able to beat the Jews at their own game.
Well, the solution is that they will be accomplished. So just that placeholder word, like we will accomplish them. And then that's the solution to the destiny question, uh-huh. accomplishment
yeah,
from the
right.
face of the earth.
Yeah. It's I mean, the only like problem with that is that this is me as a petty materialist political thinking man. Is that those Faustians who have achieved the intellectualized upper stratum of Faustians who have gotten to that point where they are intellectually able to beat the Jews at their own game, and over, you know, Spengler mentions that the Jews they had a head start. They're at an advantage because they already had the business mind. So they were able to beat, the poor dumb Faustians, at business for so long. But the problem is that the Jews are still organized as an ethnic community, whereas they've continued to prevent the organization of the Faustians as an ethnic community. So, I mean, I think that unless that is somehow accomplished, and I don't see how that gets accomplished under the in the Spenglerian paradigm, unless that's accomplished, I think the Jewish control can go on for forever.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think we could go either way with this, but I would just give the possibility that Jews have pushed the kind of hyper-liberalism onto us that is basically, other than the physical kinetic force of Hamas, is the number one danger to them coming from, like, for example, the South Africans taking them to genocide court, or the liberalism that they created in order to infect.
Right.
Is, if not this time, you know, the next time there's a big flare up or whatever,
is this where you're going with this? That the like ultimate manifestation of liberalism is National Socialism? Because that's, I mean, like, as a, you know, if you're
either that or actually denying Jewish exceptionalism to the liberalism, which is what they've struck until now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it's getting harder and harder because it's so obvious that they're not oppressed now. And I mean, more and more people are seeing these crazy
claims.
They
keep trying to throw around it's white supremacy, guys. Like, it's white supremacy that causes the problems of the world, but no one's buying it. Like, whether they be liberals or Arabs or anybody, it's like, but you're the ones who have power. So
exactly.
Why are you not, you know, why you control Harvard, yet you're saying that we can't like protest Israeli, you know, Israelis bombing little kids. Because that's the contradictions just like multiply. It's like, well, but we have freedom of speech. That's a liberal dictate. Oh no, you can't do that because you're hurting Jews. Well, Jews are not oppressed. Well, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, like I see it. Liberalism is causing or is making it such that Jews are now like threatened by the golem that they've created.
They have an impossible task, which is to preserve the liberalism, you know, of everybody else, and then the illiberalism for their community. Mm-hmm. And on a long enough timeline, it's not possible. So the only question is when, if we can speed that up or whatever, if we can accomplish that faster.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think national socialism, like, it's national. So if you are an open-minded person and you truly, like, you know, you accept and you take any idea and consider it and, you know, evaluate it based on its merits.
What Bernie Sanders advocated.
Eventually, you're going to be a Nazi. And, you know, once you, like, admit to yourself, and like, okay, fine, I'm a Nazi, then, yeah, certain other things follow from that as well. And you're just, you know, we have to get rid of Jewish power. And that is, like, the ultimate end of liberalism. So, I guess, thanks, Jews.
So I guess that's Spengler. You know, when I was going through the book, I did think that there was a little bit of a conspicuous leaving out of Jews. But actually, yeah, he has a very nuanced, also an historically based. I mean, he talks about Jews throughout time periods that most people don't really think about, like the Khazarian time periods and them being traders and Mongolian trade routes and all over the place, and elsewhere, places that I didn't know they had a presence, a significant presence. So he kind of leaves out some of the, I guess what you could say, like more vulgar points that were maybe being made. Maybe he felt like they didn't need to be made in an academic book because he could, at the time he was writing and publishing these books, he'd go outside in Germany and there's somebody, hopefully, if you're in the right neighborhood, somebody just yelling these things, or, you know, maybe you could even catch like a Hitler speech.
Windows, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe breaking some glass, by Nacht und Nebel. There's a few. So back to the, I did want to touch a little bit more on the Russian predictions and the Russian descriptions.
Yeah, right. Spengler says that Jews may have a future in Russia. And also Russia. Yeah. Russia in its own, for its own sake, too.
That I wonder about. So he writes that the real Russian is a disciple of Dostoevsky, although he may not have read Dostoevsky or anything else. Nay, perhaps because he cannot read, he is himself Dostoevsky in substance. And if the Bolshevists, who see in Christ a mere social revolutionist like themselves, were not intellectually so narrowed, it would be in Dostoevsky that they would recognize their prime enemy. What gave this revolution its momentum was not the intelligentsia's hatred, it was the people itself, which, without hatred, urged only by the need of throwing off a disease, destroyed the old Westernism in one effort of upheaval, and will send the new after it in another, which did happen. So he himself predicted the end of the Soviet Union by Russia in the same way that the Soviet Union itself was an unfortunate symptom.
Is he regarding the Russian Revolution as another manifestation of Westernism, or as – the way I understand it, he regards the Western period as circa Peter the Great until like now, World War One, and the Russian Revolution was a –
What he's saying is that it was a symptom of them throwing off that initial Westernism, but it is another Western idea, and that they will then throw that off. Basically, they had to go through this double process.
Yeah, because the basic bitch interpretation on Bolshevism is that it was like Jewish, which it was. Like, that's true. Mm-hmm. But like,
it's I think Jewish.
People kind of miss, yeah, true. People kind of miss the point that like Bolshevism was in a way like deeply Russian. I think the Russians have Spengler would say this, they have a proclivity for like brotherliness. And so I think they were very susceptible to the doctrine of like, we're all equal and we're going to have like this absurd economic system where we just share everything. And so like, while it was the Jews were like, they accidentally or intentionally had identified a very clear tendency in like Russian thinking and exploited it. And that was the Bolshevik Revolution. And then over the first like half of Soviet history, that worked itself out. And then the last half of Soviet history was more or less like a sort of
Russia
emerging again.
Yeah. And listen to this last part in light, especially of that Tucker Putin interview. For what this townless people yearns for is its own life form. So he's talking about the peasant. He was saying earlier that the cities and towns that were built too early in Russian history because they were westernized, especially Petersburg. Mm-hmm. Yearns for its own life form, its own religion, its own history. Tolstoy's Christianity was a misunderstanding. He spoke of Christ and he meant Marx. But to Dostoevsky's Christianity, the next 1,000 years will belong. So if you just look at what Putin chose to talk about, he might as well have been, you know, expanding on that sentence on the it wants its own life form, its own religion, its own history.
Mm-hmm.
Spengler saw that clearly, and it's still playing itself out. In the most important geopolitical events that are happening around us.
Yeah, I've always, in reading about Russian history, been very bored by the period of like Peter the Great on. I've always like liked the Soviet period and then the pre-Peter the Great period, because I always felt that was like more, it felt realer. It felt like this is real Russia, whereas the 1700s, 1800s, it feels like you're just reading like Western European history in like a sort of barbarized form. So
it's like the dunce kid in class, like trying to be,
mm-hmm.
you know, Prussia, like big, dumb Prussia.
Yeah. I the stuff about like medieval Russia, quote unquote, medieval Russia, Russia of the 900s to like Ivan the Terrible or so, it feels so much more natural and so much more like true to form.
Hey, speaking of the really old Russia, do you believe in the whole like sort of Scandinavian Swedish.
Okay, you're
Rus
talking about the Varangians, yeah.
So not just the Varangians, but the Rus in general.
I was surprised. So this was actually a dispute in... This is a good question. Thank you. This was a dispute for a long time in Soviet, like, historiography of was the Varangians real? And a lot of, like, the Russophiles and rejected that the story that Scandinavians had come into Russia and then established the first Russian states in Novgorod and Kiev. Or, excuse me, Kiev. And and that was the dispute. And Putin in his discussion the other day, like, he didn't even, like, make that claim. He just was like, no, like, the Varangians were real. They came from Scandinavia. They established the first Russian state. Whereas that was controversial within, like, Russian history for a long time. So I guess the Russians are back to being like, yeah, we was Varangians and stuff, which is fine. And I guess I believe that. I don't know. I'm not a specialist. I'm not terribly invested in the story one way or another, but...
But I think the best evidence is that linguistically, the word for Rus was related to that. Was it a Finnic word for Swedish?
There's a couple explanations. But yeah, that's one. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, my only question is how much of that blood, because clearly there's been mixing with Slavic peoples. So it's not like,
yeah,
you know. It's not like there's a group of, like, Swedish people in Russia that run the state and then everybody else is Slavs. It's like, it's pretty mixed at this point.
Right. And it's kind of funny because Vladimir Putin himself is very much like a Russian type. I mean, he's got the wide skull. He is a Slav.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
And then Alexei Navalny, the guy who is just off, or died or whatever, who knows. The darling, liberal darling of the West, who was the leader of the opposition in Russia. He has a very Nordic look about him. He looks very Swedish. That's just sort of ironic. But, I wanted to get into Navalny a little bit. So Navalny is, he died of last week. According to the Western papers, he was killed in prison. I don't believe anything they say, so I assume the opposite to be true. But whatever, he died. And... it's interesting because he started off as like a hardcore Russian nationalist, like white supremacist almost, like white power, like we need to separate ourselves or from like the non-Russian people in Russia, and like that should be how we run things here. But then he like over time became a liberal Democrat.
Democrats are the real racists.
I'm not gonna speculate on like the reasons. Was he bribed? Was he? Is this just a natural evolution? I don't know. But I will comment though on the weirdness of like the West supporting this guy, because Navalny is. I don't think any actual Russian finds him appealing. I don't think the typical Gopnik Slav is like, oh yes, Alexei Navalny is my czar. Like no, come on, the guy is a complete. It would be like taking like an imam out of Iran and then running them for president in America and saying like, oh, look, he has so much natural support among the people in Appalachia. It's just – it's ridiculous. It's like, no, these people – this is like not – these don't go together. If you were Zog and you wanted to gay up the Russians, who would be the guy – what sort of person would you put – forward as the quote unquote leader of the opposition to oppose Putin?
Personally, I don't,
like what ideology or what like background would he have?
I think he would have, I would try to have it be something Russian, like, more something closer to Putin himself.
Right. So what is the natural – what do you think the natural Russian form of a leader is? I mean, I think Putin is pretty close. He's like a czar masquerading as a president.
Yeah.
But could there be somebody who is a more natural leader than a Vladimir Putin? Like if you wanted to gay out the Russians into supporting somebody other than their current czar, who would be their true czar?
Is it a guy that whose name has, I don't know, been a
I'm
slur?
Not thinking of anybody in particular. I mean, I'm not going to say like Alex Ovechkin or something.
No, I was thinking of I was jokingly thinking of like Dugan or one of his followers. I guess he would be more like the
he could be more like a Rasputin.
The Rasputin. Yeah. I don't really know any Russian. I'm actually very weak on Russia in general. Like the history, I only know the outlines. And in terms of current figures, I mean, I learn about them as soon as they die, you know? Like who died this week? Oh, okay. How was he important for the last 30 years in Russia?
He's not important. It's like Navalny is on the front pages of all these Western papers, and it's like, I mean, how many people have died in Russia in the last like 10 years that were probably more important from like the point of view of your typical Russian who like everybody in the West was like, LOL, who's that? And then whenever the Western papers start getting all uppity about, oh my God, person died in Petri. It's like what they do with Princess Diana. It's the same thing. It's like, who is this bitch? Why does she matter? You have an agenda here. I don't want to listen to it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's nothing that the Western press can do to influence the hearts and minds of Russians. I mean, that decoupling, I think, has been achieved. They're just talking to themselves. They're just right. Western, you know, Jewish media is just maintaining the radicalization of white liberals against Russia.
Yeah, the Western media can. There is like a certain class of people in Moscow and St. Petersburg that the Western media can like get their hands on and influence to support faggotry or democracy, the same thing. But like as far as subversion of Russia itself, I think our intelligence organs and or ours, the Jews, whatever, the Western intelligence organs and media apparatus, like actually is at an incredible disadvantage because they don't understand the Slav. And they're like intellectually incapable of doing so, and so they come up with these ridiculous gayops that like only half work. Actually, I'll tell you, I just thought of one. Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner group.
Yeah,
he is like someone that if I was the CIA, I would cultivate and try to like build up his power and use him to do a coup d'état against Russia. I'm not sure if that's what happened. I don't pretend to know what the fuck goes on between Rostov-Nadan and Moscow. It's like Slavs doing Slav things. I don't know. But that's the kind of person, though. That Prigozhin being like a very – he's a Slav. He's very – he's a leader of men. He's brave. He's tough. He's
corrupt in the normal way.
He's normal, yes. Tastefully corrupt. He could be like a replacement czar, someone like him.
Yeah. I wouldn't put it past the CIA to have been, you know, involved.
Yeah.
Or whoever.
Right.
But yeah, I see what you mean, and I do think that Zog couldn't even put a stable puppet in places in our backyard, like Venezuela or Cuba. It can't do it in Iraq.
Just because like the mid-level bureaucracy in America just picks one of its own, or, you know, it picks a brown version of itself. It's like, oh yeah, this guy went to Princeton. He goes to the driving range sometimes. He smokes the same kind of cigars that we do. He's, you know, has a faggot roommate. I don't know. Like he looks like a bourgeois urban liberal. So like obviously he should be the leader of a country full of people, full of like pre-civilizational people who fucking hate him.
Yeah, and I think more than that. I mean, I think America is just no longer able to. You know, it's like there was a game of like overturning cards or something to claim territory, and it's like all of the cards have all been turned over. Mm-hmm. And it's shaked out the way it is. There might be some border pieces, like some people may have been surprised that Poland went so hard to NATO, at this time, but they were already kind of on that side anyway. It's not like, I mean, if you look at the attempt to overturn the Ukraine peace, right, is like the biggest fucking thing. The non-conformist countries are not going to be couped and regime changed by America anymore. I mean, there's just too much. People are so aware of it. It's like it's a meme. I mean, it's a joke. Even so, third world people, they know what the deal is. So it's that time of American geopolitical tactics is over. I mean, I guess they can kind of lie to certain. They can mess a country up a little bit and kind of give like a totally insane person like that Juan Guaido guy, the Venezuelan president in exile. They can find a delusional person to cause some type of trouble, but the chance that he was ever going to.
Yeah, it's like it's like with the Yemen. I mentioned Houthis earlier. So they keep saying Houthis in the news. Mm-hmm. But this is just like the government of the Yemen. And they act like, oh, it's just Houthi rebels. It's like, well, where the fuck is the real government? You keep talking about Houthi rebels. it's like, oh, the real government is sitting at the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. Okay. Right. That seems like the kind of people that like your typical Yemeni's goat herd wants some asshole sitting in the Ritz-Carlton 600 miles to the north to be his president when, like, you know, your based Houthi missile like launching commander is like doing God Allah's work destroying Israel.
Yeah, well, America can no longer recognize a government that doesn't, you know, have like Holocaust museums and whatever. Gay marriage or
no, like you said recognized. I agree with you in both senses of that word. It cannot recognize the government officially, and it also can't like pick out the people that should run a country based on what the country actually is, because it doesn't have the like intellectual psychological understanding of foreigners right. To be like, okay, these people actually this is what a fucking Yemeni's leader looks like. They have no idea. Same thing. I mean, obviously, like you said, Venezuela or Ukraine. I mean, Yulia Tymoshenko or the braided blonde haired fake Aryan who's actually a Jewish Ukrainian politician. She's still around. She's in the Congress, Ukrainian Congress. People like this, like just complete puppet clowns. They can't recognize who like a real leader, who someone actually in this country would respect and want to follow, like who the natural leader. I mean, like the Western press will admit even now that the vast majority of Russians support Putin. Well, it's just because the Russian people are propagandized too. It's like, well, but Americans are propagandized too. And our support of our government is what? 20%? 20% of people are stupid enough to actually like this government. So yeah, I mean, all right, losers. No, wait.
Yeah, it's funny the way that at this point with the West saying like, oh, you know, it's like, oh, wouldn't you know it? There was another election that they didn't want, and it happened to also be not free and fair again. Like, God, dag nabbit, this always happens. You know, whenever there's a threat to democracy candidate, he always wins in a not free and fair election. This is outrageous.
Yeah, it's like. Spengler talks a lot about the emergence of like barbarism in late stage societies. We're also fed up with like democracy. Like if tomorrow we could decide the presidential election based on like a WWE SmackDown, Ultimate Combat, every American would be like, fuck yeah, let's do it. Like that sounds that, and they wouldn't be wrong in wanting that, because that is a much more rational way to decide your political leadership than free and fair elections.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Kant called the Jews a nation of cheaters.
an understatement, I think, from the doctor.
Yeah, it's tasteful. I have one more quote that I wanted to read about Russia a little bit. Back to their religion, because I think the key to understanding them is to understand that they are following a new religion. Mm-hmm. And by new, I mean in the way that the Catholic Church led Western Europe for a long time. Okay. And was not was a new religion.
Right. The Catholic Church wasn't like Roman. I mean, it wasn't the same as Roman paganism. Like it adopted some of the outward forms. Like it calls the Pope Pontifex Maximus, but it was clearly a new religious system.
Yeah, and it was driving what was clearly like a new, younger culture. So he writes, the Western Church continued to be bound up with the fate of the Roman Empire. That is, the cult church became the state. Gradually, it absorbed into itself the adherents of the pagan church. And therefore, its importance lay not so much in itself, for Islam almost annihilated it, but in the accident that it was from it that the young peoples of the Western culture received the Christian system as the basis for a new creation. In other words, the original Christianity, you know, that grew up
the
in Rome.
St. Augustine or the Monophysites or Eastern Christianity, that Christianity was almost pretty much wholly overwhelmed by Islam.
Right. And that was used as just a substrate, like clay, mm-hmm. but for Western Europe. And he has I'll finish the sentence, but he has a footnote that I'll read. He says, receiving it, moreover, in the Latin guise of the extreme West, which for the Greek church itself was unmeaning since Rome was now a Greek city, and the Latin language was far more truly at home in Africa and Gaul. And the footnote says, after Christian system as the basis for a new creation, it says, and Russia too, though hitherto Russia has kept it as a buried treasure. So Russia is building its own Christianity that is going to affect it in the future the way the Western European church did. And I think it has kept it's not advertising it in big bombastic ways the way Europe did with its Catholicism, and then of course with the split. It's horizontal, not vertical, I guess, type of development.
With the Russian church, I mean, the counter theory, the conventional theory on Russia is that, I don't know which, maybe you know which scholar came up with this, but the lecture that you get in high school is something like, well, Russia developed different from the West because it was influenced by the Byzantine Empire and Byzantine Christianity, whereas the Western Europe was influenced by Western Rome and Catholicism. And now, Spengler would disagree with that. I think that is a superficial analysis. I think Spengler's analysis is better, which is to say that the West, what you just said, like Western spirituality was emerging and it seized onto this little kernel of Christianity that was, outside of the Meiji civilization. And then it developed that into its own whole religious expression, which we call Catholicism and then later Protestantism. Whereas in Russia, you're going to see the same development where a little piece of like Byzantine Christianity got brought into Russia and has been sort of badly understood by the Slavs for 1,000 years now. And they're like turning it into their own thing over time. You see in like Russian folk traditions, it's very alien. And then they're like folklore. It's very, very different from like anything you'd see in like Greece or in like the Christianity. Their superstitions and folk, the remnants of like their paganism, that are still like affecting their worldview, which is very different from anything you'd see in like the more, the Middle East or like Greece or anything like that. So it does stand. I think it is, if you're looking for like the true Russia, looking at the Slavs of circa 900 AD is actually much more predictive than looking at, say, Byzantium of like 1400 and saying, well, this is like the Orthodox Church and this is how things are going to go. So yeah, when all these nerds like attack Putin for talking, or sorry, not nerds, that's the wrong insult. When these press faggots talked about, when Putin talked about 900 AD Russia, it's like, yes, that is the relevant fact. 988, conversion to Christianity, baptism of by Vladimir the Great, of the Rus in Kiev by driving all the Slavs into the Dnieper River to be baptized. That is a more pertinent political and cultural fact than whatever the fuck happened in like 2008. So yes. And also is it a coincidence that Vladimir the First of Kiev, the first one to Christianize Rus, was also called Vladimir? Do you think Vladimir Putin sees himself a little bit in Vladimir the First?
Yeah, I think the other way to look at the press reaction is there anything Putin could have said outside of like, you know, I've been thinking about legalizing the gay marriage, that they wouldn't have attacked? I mean, it's just like, it's like they're sitting there on the edge of their chair, you know, with their like their soy lattes like shaking in their hands, waiting to write some kind of hit piece on whatever he says.
Yeah, right.
It's silly to when it's the like, idea that they're going to dispassionately journalize about it.
It was comical to me seeing. I mean, it's worth watching the whole interview. I don't know if you're maybe most people aren't entertained by this. I was just watching prep school Tucker Carlson talking to like King Slav Vladimir Putin was hilarious. Like the way that they're like missing each other's jokes and not understanding the context of what the other one is saying was so funny. Like it was a parody of like the West talking to the East. Tucker's jokes just came across to the Russian mind, I think, came across as like, this guy's a fucking idiot. Or it's like, he's insultingly stupid. And because he's a clever, you know, Westerner, he's clearly doing this to mock us. Whereas like Putin's jokes came across as like creepy and like mildly threatening. But it was shocking to me that Tucker like clearly didn't know what Putin was talking about. Like the whole part of the interview up until the name Hitler is mentioned, Tucker is just sitting there like
with one of the Tucker faces. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Tucker has been practicing flabbergasted faces for his entire career.
No. So. It was more than I know what you're talking about. It was more than the usual Tucker, like the I'm super concerned look, like yeah. He does, where he's like, he looks a little bit constipated. He's like, it was more than that. This was a genuine look of unknowing. It was, yeah, normally his look is like, I see what you're saying and it's fucking stupid. But this was the look of, I am bewildered at what's being said. It was a look he probably gave to his high school or his teachers in like Switzerland when he like bailed out of prep school because he didn't pay attention. That was the look he was given.
Yeah, I think I will watch the whole thing at some point.
It was very funny. Tucker is the parody of the spoiled like aristocrat. I mean, I didn't really know that this type existed in the West anymore. I think he's the only one maybe.
He seems like what he's like. He's kind of has this small amount of rebelliousness where either. I mean, did he not get the position that he wanted and now he's rebelling, or was he always a little rebellious, therefore he didn't get the position in society that he wanted? Mm-hmm. And that's why he, you know, is this kind of weird version of like a New England blue blood gonzo journalist. Like,
yeah.
He's like a $100 million, you know, net worth $100 million gonzo journalist.
Yeah, you feel like he doesn't really want to be doing this. He's like more comfortable on the golf course, drinking a martini.
I mean, he's like Trump, you know. He comes from the same place as all these people. They all look down at him, the upper class people, and true. Then he sort of bests them in a lot of things. But he kind of maybe just wants to be inside. And because he can never be inside like Trump, this dynamic will continue for the rest of his life. Where he sort of, because he is smarter than the average actual just elite, you know, shithead.
Right. But he's also like.
Not that that's saying much.
No, it isn't. It isn't saying much. Yes, Tucker's definitely smart, but he's also like. I don't know how the hell do you go to interview the president of Russia and you, I don't know, didn't read the Wikipedia entry on like Russian history.
So the clips that I saw, the vibe that I got, and the reason why I didn't watch the whole thing is because I felt that he was either afraid of making Putin look good, so he was very tight.
Yeah, there, There was a bit of that going on for sure, yeah.
And that maybe he was even threatened, or, you know, the theory that he is actually a CIA agent and that he wasn't not hired, but hired.
Oh, that was hilarious. That was so funny. Because, like, Putin called him out for that. And maybe you saw that clip.
He
said, oh, it was just like you wanted to be. And like, either way it works, because whether Tucker is or isn't a CIA agent, it just, like, you can see why you should have known Putin was going to go for that, because it's either a bance, it's either a compliment, like, I know you're CIA, don't play with me. Or it's an insult, like, ah, oh, you weren't good enough to get into CIA, but that's it.
I was a serious organization.
KGB man, I ran KGB. Yeah. I did all the KGB things. You did nothing.
We could have been colleagues.
I studied German, did you know? But, yeah, it was... The more interesting thing about the whole Tucker-Putin interview was the reaction from the Western media, which just showed the complete... I mean... Getting back to Spangler here, it's like one could expect the West not to understand Russia whatsoever, because it is an alien civilization. They are a young people, and they think about the whole world very differently from the way we do. But on the other hand, like, if you're the press or, like the diplomatic class, you're supposed to be able to understand. Your job is understanding foreigners, right? It's like a trucker's job is understanding how to drive a truck. If you don't understand foreigners, what is your fucking purpose? Like, what are you doing? In fact, it's dangerous. If you don't understand how to understand foreigners, and you're in the press and you're informing the rest of us about who we should go to war with, or who we should, like, cut off relations with, or whatever, where we should spend lots of money, then you're like, it's malpractice. You're dangerous at your job, and you shouldn't be there.
Well, that's why they're there.
Yeah.
And you can understand how Putin would have a level of awkwardness with the Western media, because he is smart and he sees this insane system where there's people, you know, like real politicians here and really high ranking journalists that are, like, calling for, you know, attacking Russia. And you know, he sees these things and he's like, geez, like, these people are crazy.
I'll give you an anecdote. So about this specific thing about Russians encountering American politicians and being like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? So back in 2009, I did an internship for the State Department in Vilnius, Lithuania, because I was super interested in Lithuania. I didn't give a shit about, like, this was before this was cool. Nobody back then ever was like, well, you care about Russia? Like, oh, it's good. It's China. Anyway, it sucked. It was whatever. There's a lot I could say about that, but the relevant story here is a bunch of American politicians came to Russia or to Lithuania to, that summer for like a week. American senators, I think Ben Cardin was there. Some other people. And they had, a sit down meeting with the Russians. And so my job in all this was, I was supposed to sit on like a bus and like tell the bus driver where to go, because the bus drivers didn't speak English. And the, you know, State Department people would call me and say, hey, tell the bus driver to go over here, pick up these politicians. And so at one point I'm standing outside this room where they're having this conference between some Russian diplomats, and these American politicians. And this one black lady, she was a congresswoman from somewhere in the South. She's like droning on about some anecdote about Farmer Bill or whoever the fuck, like her constituent, to make some belabored point that had enough. It was, I don't know what she was talking about. And the Russians got out of that meeting and they were fucking pissed. They looked like they wanted to kill somebody. And like, which I completely understood, because I was just hearing like little snippets of this as I was like in the ante room. And I was like, what the fuck is she talking about? Like, you're letting this woman talk to these serious people. And she's, you know, through the translator, obviously droning on about some random asshole she knows. Like, this, could you have picked a, could you have been more insulting? It's like talking to a, the Arabs and like taking your shoe off and like wiping it on their like face. It was amazing.
Was she loud?
Yes. Yes. And I'm sure she wasn't the worst. I don't want to insult black ladies here. Like, I'm sure the other politicians, the other Jews were like equally retarded and evil. But like, yeah, these Russians were just like visibly angry. And that's just like, that's the story of Western relations with, you know, Russia for like the past 20 years, 30 years, at least.
Yeah. Do you have any other Russian points to cover?
I don't recall Spengler saying this exactly, but the Russians do seem to have a real genius for like simplicity. Like in their design of weapons and everything, like everything they do is like designed for the illiterate peasant, and it works under all conditions. I mean, it's like a stereotype almost about like the AK-47 or the T-34 tank or the Mosin Nagant rifle. Like they're all like just ingeniously idiot proof. And like, whereas the Westerner, the American or the German will like spend millions and millions of dollars designing like a super complicated sight for their weapon or designing some like incredibly complicated machine process, that requires the parts to be absolutely perfect. Yeah, think of the Tiger tank or the Panther. The Slav will just design the most simple like thing that can be produced under all conditions and will work 30 years, 50 years, 100 years later, and it won't be a problem. You know, once I walked into a sauna that the latch on the door was broken, and somebody had like taken apart a metal hanger and then wrapped it around the door knob and then like affixed it so that it like actually was able to close the door fully without the latch working. And I was like, you know what? This was definitely a fucking Russian did this, because a Westerner would have come in here and would have like unscrewed the thing and like put in a new doorknob and the new handle, would have spent, you know, $500 doing it. But like the Slav comes in and like just takes a 25-cent piece of metal, unwraps it, and like makes the thing that works.
Yeah, he did. Spengler did say that they had a genius for religion, but he didn't mention that they have a genius for ghetto rigging engineering.
Yes, that's a polite way of putting it. Yes, ghetto rigging. But yeah, just to wrap up, I do. Spengler is just an infinite source of you know, talking points and things, kind of ways to analyze history and politics. And I know we sort of swung back and forth between Spenglerian, like philosophical, historical talking and maybe more geopolitical, like current events stuff. But it all kind of comes together. I think the ultimate way to, if you really want to understand a foreign culture, and this is like the method that I would prescribe for diplomats or for journalists who are, you know, not careerist shitheads, but who actually want to be good at their jobs, is you really have to just immerse yourself in that culture, like learn their language, spend time with them, read their books, learn their history, and don't read their history from like the popular histories of Jews who write for Harvard. Read the people who really understood those people, and listen to their music too. That's another one. Like, you listen to their music, and you'll start to get a sense of, okay, this is, if your like brain starts to like enjoy their music, I think you start to be able to see things in the way they see things. I know that's like a highly pseudoscientific claim, but I think it more or less conforms to Spengler. Spengler would say, yeah, that you're, you know, the musical sense of somebody, you can tell, like, if you're dealing with really alien people, like the Arabs, and you play Arab music for Westerners, most Westerners like cringe at it. Like if you play like Quran for Westerners, it's like, ew, what the fuck is this? Whereas Arabs sit there for hours and like, yes, yes. Or if you played some Mozart for them, that might be like, ugh, cringe. And that, music and art and literature, these are just all really important if you're actually going to understand a foreign culture. And so anybody, it is correct. The bias, it is correct to assume that somebody who hasn't done those things doesn't know shit about the culture they're talking about. For instance, Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, the total neocon shill. He, like, speaks Russian, allegedly. Maybe, you know, not that I speak Russian. I studied it, but I'm not great. But he, like, this is somebody who, whether or not, no matter how good his technical knowledge of Russian is, the guy doesn't understand the first thing about Russia. And you can see it in all of his statements. He's, like, a complete NATO shill and just utterly, like, contemptible person. I can't imagine why. I mean, I can't imagine why a good-hearted government that was interested in having good relations or even functioning relations with Russia would send this jackass to Moscow.
Yeah, well, they're clearly not interested in that.
Yeah.
I actually have a couple of I can send you on Telegram some Russian music.
Okay.
Like, as in popular music. But they have some interesting kind of, I don't know what you call it, like their own take on sort of synth music. And like in the 80s, they had some cool stuff. And
they had a
movie culture.
Hard music in the 80s, like Vladimir Vysotsky. It's like this poetry set to a very simple musical tune.
Hmm.
It was a very popular thing in the 80s in Russia.
Yeah, that's another way that you can tell is that their literary and artistic worlds are not shared with ours.
Right. You know, actually, this reminds me, the best way, like if you want to understand the Russians and especially the Ukrainian question in under 2 hours, watch the movie Brat 2. So Brat means brother in Russian. Brat 2 is, you know, the sequel to Brat 1. But Brat 2 is better because it's a story of a Russian gangster who gets assigned to go to America to find I don't know, have you seen it?
No, I'm looking at the trailer.
He's assigned to go to America to work out this problem that there's a hockey player from Russia who's being taken advantage of by like an oligarch, a Russian oligarch there. And so, or Ukrainian actually. And so the Russian gangster's job is to go there and find the guy. And the whole movie is it's almost a meme in Russia, like the whole movie. But it shows their attitude toward the West. It shows their attitude toward like Ukrainians. It shows their personal like foibles. You can learn a lot just from watching that movie. So for instance, there's a scene where the gangster has to go get some weapons. And so he meets up with a guy called Fascist, who wears like a German army uniform and has like a basement full of like old World War II weapons that, you know, you can buy. This is Russia in the 90s. You just buy like, you know, an MG-42 for like 200 rubles or whatever. And so he goes down into this basement with Fascist and he's asking the guy like, oh, so are you a fascist? And he's like, no. And he's like, well, but, you know, it's, you know, my granddad, you know, died in World War II. And Fascist is like, no, it happens. and the gangster is like, oh, you're right, I guess. And he's like, cool with him. And that's like, that is the Russian it's really weird. The attitude on like the West is, it varies from like just rabid hatred of like Nazis. There are people who are like that, but they're in the minority in my estimation. It's like they recognize like, oh, you're fascist. You're like dressed like a Nazi, but they're kind of like, oh yeah, it happened. Whatever. Germans are cool. Like, yeah. And they also like can't tell the difference between an American and a German. Like the real Russian peasant has no fucking idea. Like to them, like us and Germans are about as different as like Ukrainians and Russians are to us. So like you'll regularly confuse you with a German or try to speak to you in German. It's very funny. But the climax of the movie is the gangster goes to meet with the oligarch, to demand that this hockey player be released from, like, you know, debt slavery. And he walks into the room. He shoots, like, the guy who's sitting there playing chess with the oligarch. He sits down, pours vodka, like a fucking glass full of vodka for both. He, like, drinks his in one draught. And then he starts lecturing the oligarch on power. And he says, power comes from truth. And I have the truth. And the truth is that da-da-da-da-da. And it's a very, like, in a way, it's a very Nazi, like, lecture. And it's something that is, I find personally inspirational. That, like, yeah, you know, you can be an oligarch with all this money and control people as, like, your slaves. But if you're a fucking liar and a piece of shit, like, eventually you're going to get cut down by somebody who speaks the truth. So.
That sounds cool.
I encourage you, Roman, to watch the movie. It's very entertaining.
Year 2000?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
So, yeah, any last thoughts, or should we close out?
Just that, yeah, I mean, people, you know, there's a lot of jokes, and merited jokes, about, you know, Russia, and it's kind of like a lot of goofy things happen, a lot of funny internet videos of people doing funny things, but, you know, things are kind of funny over here, too, not so funny, and not so serious, and in a lot of ways, they're more serious than us, and they're... they should not be taken lightly, and that, there's a lot of interesting things that will be coming from there. Things are not going to settle like this. Things are not they're not going to go back to being like, you know, Europe at home or whatever, like second tier Europe. They have decoupled, you know, this Ukraine thing has caused them to economically decouple in a lot of ways that they were not before, and that's not going to go back the way it was before, and interesting things will happen.
Yeah, I agree. Interesting things will happen, and that's a very good point, but as much as, like, Russia does, I mean, we joke about it because it's fun to joke about, and it's, like, intrinsically interesting, you know, watching, like, Russian dash cam videos, the Russians just being nonplussed by, like, total disasters happening right in front of them. Whereas an American would be like, oh my God, yeah! It's very funny, but, you know, it kind of puts things in perspective because things in the West are so, like, dangerously insane that, we almost just don't recognize it anymore. And you kind of, it's nice to be able to remove yourself from your own surroundings and then gaze back on America or on the West with those, like, fresh eyes, and you're always, like, shocked at how insane things are here. So,
yes.
Yeah. So thanks, Roman, for coming on, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes, sir. My pleasure.
All right. Until next time, Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.